All right, and welcome to this episode of All Damn Night. I'm your host, Brandon Richardson. This is your resident expert,
Sean Demers. Good to be back.
Always good to have Sean. So this is the, if you haven't tuned in with us before, this is a music history podcast. We're not particularly uniquely qualified to talk about any of this stuff, but...
Well, who is qualified?
Anyway? Yeah, go fuck yourself. We're going to tell a cool story, hang out, have a good time. It's like an after party. It's hanging out with your buddies, talking shit, so enjoy. Damn night.
With technical difficulties.
We are a true triumph of the human spirit in the amount of technical difficulties that we have overcome.
Well, if it was easy, it wouldn't be worth doing, right?
Oh, it'd definitely be worth doing. Oh, it'd probably make things a whole lot better because we'd get a whole lot done. It'd be easier.
Well, if you look at it that way.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely probably the easiest way to look at it. So, the year... Sean, is 1917, and the world is on fire over Europe. Basically, yes. Yeah. All over Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia, and in nearly every major ocean on Earth, world war was being waged on a scale that seemed unimaginable just 3 years earlier. Millions have died. Millions more will die yet.
This is heavy, heavy way to start.
Right into the deep end. Yeah. Right into the deep end, my friend. After years of managing to stay out of the war, the United States entered in 1917 on the side of the Allied powers, namely France and Great Britain.
So why did they enter the war? I read about this in History 1.
They tried to stay out of it for so long, but eventually it got to be where, like...
Was it economic interests?
They were making a lot of money off of not being in the war.
Okay.
Yeah, it was more just like, well, we're going to have to do something to get in here and... Worst experience in human history. There's so many countries from India to Australia to Canada to the Taiwanese to the Japanese to the Russians and people in the DRC in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So every continent was involved. This is like the first truly global conflict.
What about our boy in Uganda?
Yes, also involved
as well.
I'm sure you have some ancestors who fought in the Great War. Big shout out to you.
For those of you who don't know, we have one listener in Uganda who's very loyal.
Let me correct you there. One so far.
Yeah, one so far. That's
once you
correct.
You start with one, and you build from there. It's the Ugandan way. The first engagement of U.S. forces was at the Battle of Katigny. Battle of Katigny in late May of 1917, where they defeated... Sean, I'm trying to do a podcast. Where they defeated German forces despite suffering 1,400 casualties. Now the U.S. was in the deep end of the most violent and costly conflict the world had ever seen. And much would be asked of many, many citizens before this was all over. Perhaps none more so than the men of the 369th Infantry Regiment.
Okay.
Ring a bell?
No.
No, of course it doesn't. I know. That's why we're doing this podcast. At this time, the U.S. Army was still a segregated service, meaning black and white units did not mix, and black units were often thought of as inferior and often giving less funding and attention than other units. The 369th was comprised of men from Harlem, and was thought to be so inferior that they were given over to the command of the French army in December of 1917. So, like, they're still part of the U.S. Army, but they're put under French command because they're just...
That's strange, because there were African-American regiments in the Civil War.
In the Civil War, right. It's not like it's new to comprise an African... If you've ever seen the movie Glory, another great movie, about the first African-American regiment comprised in the Civil War... And then there was Buffalo Soldiers after the Civil War, through American history. Even before that, in the American Revolution in 1812. But this is just to illustrate the point that it's still a segregated service, and that they were. It's not unusual for them to be loaned out essentially to the French army, and that's not. I don't think it's still totally unusual where you're put in a battle space there where you're under the command of another country's officers.
It seems like at the time they were seen as expendable, maybe?
I think that's... We'll get to that. They're okay. Put into... We'll get to it.
It's like in Braveheart when the English send the Irish in.
Actually, that's not a bad analogy. That's actually a pretty apt because, but not entirely. They were kind of thought of, we're going to get into it, but they were thought of as not being, not cannon fodder because they weren't, what's the word I'm looking for?
Combustible?
No, right. No, they, adept or, they weren't good enough soldiers to be frontline.
Okay.
So even as putting them there to be cannon fodder wasn't really in the mind. It was more like they could be used for backline services.
Right.
Doing all the real grunt work of hauling the food and digging the trenches and
bodies.
Yes. Yeah. Stuff like that. Where that's what they were initially put on. So the soldiers. This is from Wikipedia. The soldiers of the 369th. We're lucky in many ways compared to other African-American military units in France in 1918. They enjoyed a continuity of leadership commanded throughout the war by one of their original organizers, Colonel William Hayward. And unlike many white officers serving in the black regiments, Colonel Hayward respected his troops, he dedicated himself to their well-being, and leveraged his political connections to secure support for them.
He's going for general.
He's making moves, yes. He's trying to endear himself to all demographics. No, but he seemed like a good guy who was at least trying to, and then that's, you know, at the regimental level, but like he's trying to do his best by the guys that he's leading.
Well, yeah, so it makes sense, and morally it's great.
Yeah,
it seems like a stand-up guy. But also, if you're given a regiment of soldiers who don't like you, they may turn on you.
Very good point. And that often happened. That happened in World War One, not infrequently, where guys would just say, you know what, fuck this guy and kill him. Because how do you know it wasn't a bomb or whatever? How do you know he didn't get shot by? So anyways, it was not uncommon. Whereas the African-American valor usually went unrecognized, well over 100 members of the regiment received American and or French medals. By the end of the war.
So the French medals are the ones made of cheese?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And
like the Scientology
one? They come with a very nice gift basket.
some olives,
yeah,
a bunch of crackers.
Bed Bath & Beyond gift certificate. Yeah. You have to redeem it by the end of the year?
That's where they get you. They get you into the store.
Can't tell you how many times it's been January of the next year and I've wanted to go to Bed Bath & Beyond. That could be a podcast in and of itself, really.
Well, yeah, let's do that. We've all been there. Yeah.
Take into account what life was like on the front for these purposes, specifically on the Western Front in 1917. The trenches were constantly flooding. They were washing up human waste, dead bodies, and feasting on those bodies were thousands and thousands of rats.
When were trenches pretty much made obsolete? It was before World War II, right?
As far as the kind of trench warfare that's when World War One is when it was made obsolete because they realized that they just couldn't fight that type of war with the type of technology that they had.
Stalemates, unless they used gas and stuff like that.
I've always been a World War One nerd, but during the during the research for any World War One topic, it's always anytime you research any personal story in World War One, it's always like the level of horrific, pointless violence. Like, it wouldn't even matter how good you were. It was just luck whether you made it through. It didn't get blown up.
It seemed like they had a lot of time on their hands as well.
In between, right. Yeah. So, and you're just young guys. Yeah. So they're just, trying not to go crazy. Well, here he talks even more about this. Shells rained down day and night for weeks on end, giving rise to a new condition doctors hadn't quite figured out yet, called shell shock, in which a man's nerves essentially gave out from constant torment of wondering if the next loud bang spelled the end of him or the end of his buddies.
Oh, wow.
And during that war, there's tons of accounts where guys...
Where is this?
On the Western Front, specifically, is basically between France and Germany.
Okay.
And Germany invaded France through Belgium.
Okay.
So they came in through Belgium, invaded France, and now there's a line that runs from fucking... Eastern Germany and Eastern France, almost to Eastern Europe, all the way clear to the Baltic Seas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's just a big, long, not a continuous trench, like not a continuous one. Right. So it's a series. Right. But yeah,
we're not talking El Chapo here.
No, but we are talking. it's another turning point in how they viewed even mental health, because guys that would have that shell shock, especially in the early years of the war, there's a bunch of accounts, not unrecognized. They'd fucking execute them for it.
Oh wow!
Like if they couldn't perform anymore, they'd say you're a fucking coward. You're not meeting your duties, and they'd just take them out and put them in front of a firing squad. Wow. And shoot. There's a if you haven't heard and you are interested in more World War One history, definitely check out Dan Carlin's Blueprint for Armageddon.
Okay.
It is the definitive
podcast. It's almost like an audiobook.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's like 24 hours of content. Wow. But he talks about, that was a lot of the research I did. He talks about a guy who was a young kid who broke down. He had seen his entire regiment die. He had terrible PTSD. He's shaking and crying, and he had run off, and he wasn't able to fight anymore. And the captain told him he was going to be executed, but then he explained to him how it was like a brave thing to just stand there and be executed. And the guy like calmed down and like stood there, and like they shot him in the chest, and that was the end of that. Brave, and how many? Huh? Yeah, how many? Like how maybe, bizarre? Maybe. This is bizarro steampunk shit.
You probably gave him a choice. It's like either you can stand there or we'll torture you to death.
I mean, they're just gonna shoot him in the head either way. But the way that they're able to, this is when, and Dan Carlin talks about this, when the psyche of the world shifted from that old mentality of like
the honor. Firing squad. That's such a
you could convince somebody that like it was an honorable way to die, to just stand there and take it.
Well, you know why they had multiple shooters as well, so no one was to blame specifically. When did the English get involved?
In the very beginning, 1914.
Okay.
Yeah.
A couple stories, a couple all damn night factoids on that subject. Sir Patrick Stewart of Star Trek.
Yeah.
He tells a story about his father being shell-shocked.
No shit.
And how it went on. It was a broadcast on this, I think it was on BBC, could be wrong. But he went on the show and they like kind of talked to like a therapist on a live situation. And they talked about his father and how he had like issues growing up with violence with him. But I guess Patrick Stewart's father had undiagnosed shell shock. And so that was what was troubling him. But I used to play in this jazz group in the second part of this factoid.
That's quite the same mission. Yeah.
I used to play in this jazz group with this brilliant jazz improvisational pianist at Don. And he would tell stories about growing up learning to play piano in the dark. Because if they had the candles or the lights going, they would get bombed.
Right. Yeah.
It's insane the amount of the Greatest Generation? Is that what they call it?
So that's World War II, but it's like, I mean, it's comparable in that it's a worldwide.
See, this guy was 90 something. Okay.
Oh, you would still probably you're probably thinking, well,
maybe
I don't
it was
know.
Two then. But yeah.
When was this? Like, when were you in the.
He's probably pushing 100 now.
Yeah, I mean, if he served in World... Yeah, I think he served. You're talking World War II, because...
But still, that's incredible. Yeah. And a lot of these guys were undiagnosed.
And this is the war that created that war.
Right.
Like, this is Adolf Hitler was on the Western Front, and he was awarded for valor. Like, he went out and saved a guy. He ran out of the trenches.
Right.
He saved a guy, brought him back. The guy ended up dying.
That's right.
But they awarded him a medal and like.
When was the Geneva Convention?
Obviously, this is not pro Hitler. Like, it's not endorsing. I'm saying like
Hitler, but it's just interesting.
That's where he developed a lot of his
some compassion behind all of
it. And that's where he started his fucking crazy rhetoric too. It was like in the trenches, and he would just get certain random guys to start listening and.
Like
it shaped a lot of Churchill. Churchill also participated in the war.
So when was the Geneva Convention where they outlawed the using of gas and
post World War One? Yeah.
So I guess at that time in the trenches they would have like star and diamond shaped.
Yeah, we'll
blades.
Talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know. I'm just a resident expert amateur surgeon.
Yes.
But it's a lot more difficult to sew up
puncture.
Yeah, that has three sides than it does two. It's almost impossible.
And then we're talking, like you were saying, by 1915, gas tax super common occurrence, yeah. In which chemicals like chlorine would disintegrate the lining of the throat and lungs, killing its victims in a horrific fashion. In the podcast, Dan Carlin refers to it as imagining taking a giant can of Raid and spraying it over a giant field of human beings.
Literal air Raid.
Just a bunch of like Raid, like you'd spray on ants. The gas would settle in the trenches, leaving a film on puddles of rainwater and waste and the dirt itself. So if you came through and kicked that dust up or got that water on your skin, like it would burn your skin. If you somehow drank it, it would kill you a year later.
It's even hard for us to even imagine. Like, it's, you know, even playing like a video game set in that time period, it's still, you don't even conceive it to be real.
It just looks, it's, if you see pictures of it, brutal. It looks like the moon. It looks like the surface of the moon. It's just, there's no, it's, it, what it used to be, farmland and woods, is just craters from artillery.
Right.
And just barbed wire and gray and just dirt. Above the parapets lining the trenches, the vast expanse known as No Man's Land, things were even worse than they were in the trenches. Pictures of these areas, like we're saying, they look like the moon. There's craters from artillery shells all over the place. There's landmines, concertina wire. And on the other side, there's small arms fire. There's grenades. There's machine guns. There's more artillery. And all there is just a line of people waiting there to cut you down.
With just the top of their head sticking up over the trench.
Right.
When, speaking of No Man's Land, when was that Christmas Day when the
1914
when they played the soccer match,
right? And they were ordered, so what happened was 1914 was this watershed year where it's like, wow, what a horrible conflict that we are. It's like any other horrible war where you think it's going to be over by Christmas, but they lose millions of people, or hundreds of thousands at least, by Christmas 1914, and they have a truce, like an impromptu truce among the troops.
Day. Yeah.
So they were out playing soccer and sharing candy and stuff. And
it was day, not official.
No, because the day after, the generals got a hold of all the all the officers in charge of those guys and said, this is never going to fucking happen again. Right. Like, this is not ever happening again. And it never did.
Well, when you start to relate to your opponent in war, it gets you soft.
Yeah.
I can imagine. You know, if you were fighting it out with somebody over one specific issue, and then you start to see their point of view.
Isn't over one specific issue. Yeah. If you don't know, like, the war started because the Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife were assassinated. And so, basically, through a series of treaties, like dominoes, Germany is in conflict with... where was he from? The Archduke Franz Ferdinand of... it's just this. I can't, it's Treaty such a complex Versailles? Fucking mess. No. That's Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife are assassinated. So by the Black Hand, and so they're assassinated. Anyways, Germany gets in conflict, and then France gets in conflict, and then Britain gets into the conflict. So it's just all these treaties. Like, if you're in it, then I've got to be in it.
Right.
So
right.
It's just by de facto, eventually, the entire world, by this big spider web of treaties and alliances, is in this massive conflict. Like, how, you know, a bunch of Italians got to fight in the Alps because the Archduke was assassinated.
The grape growing here is terrible.
Or why Lawrence of Arabia came to be because the Archduke of Archduke was assassinated. Yeah, this is all from World War One. Once you get to the other trench, say you're going across No Man's Land, they blow a whistle, you've got to get up across that trench, get up over that trench, go across hundreds of yards of No Man's Land.
The other side, like, the knows you're coming.
Once you get to that other side, hand-to-hand combat is not uncommon. It would be you and your buddies versus one, two, or even more of the enemy with brass knuckles, knives, bayonets, rocks, bare hands, and by this time in the war, they were using more common than not trench spades.
Yeah.
Because they found that they'd be really sharp from digging all the time.
Yep.
And, handy bit, a little factoid.
Here we go.
They don't stick in the rib cage.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pulls right
That's
out.
That's interesting.
Easy peasy.
Obviously, a design flaw overlooked.
It sounds like an amazing design.
Yeah, it's kind of like how the potato chip was made.
I think you're right. Sean's metaphor there is right on.
Real happy accident.
People hacking each other to death with trench spades is like how the potato chip was made. You're right.
You heard it here first.
That is very true.
But no, it's just interesting. They had long-range weapons. They had short trench weapons, like shotguns and things like that. But
it seems
like the improvised, you know, brutal, what do I have in my hand that I can swing at this other guy and, you know, put him on the ground? That seems like the most effective thing. You know, gun's going to run out of bullets.
It just depended. Like, I don't think it wasn't the most common by any means. Like, vast majority
we're
of
still
casualties.
Talking cavalry at this time as well.
Up until probably 1916-17,
it's so
you're making cavalry charges.
First generation.
At the same time, you've got while you have cavalry charges going, you also have airplanes flying overhead. Doing reconnaissance photography.
If you want to call them that. I guess technically
biplanes were, I mean, by the end of the war especially, and like any other war, it sped the technological development. Yeah. So by the end of the war, they're landing planes on ships.
Right.
You know, and they're doing dogfights.
Yeah.
There was no dogfighting at the beginning of
World
War I.
The Red Baron? The Snoopy is the Red Baron.
That didn't exist in 1914, right. But by 1918, those guys were rock stars.
Oh, man.
So in this war, it's do or die, it's kill or be killed, and regardless of your training or tactics, the only thing that will really pull you through in this war is the luck of the draw.
Yeah.
Because the vast majority of casualties are because of artillery.
Right.
If you've ever seen, we'll post a picture, but if you've ever seen pictures of artillery officers standing on the shells that they've launched, it's 15 feet high of just shells, and there's
the
mountains
pile
of everywhere.
Empty shells.
Millions and millions
of
millions.
Not to mention all these shells
them.
Are high explosive, maybe 6 inches to 2 feet in diameter. I think the Nazis had
oftentimes still there.
Yeah,
like people are killed
live.
Every year
they're
in France
live.
And Germany by ammunition round or by artillery rounds that are plowed up or
definitely.
Hit. Yeah.
The Nazis had the biggest cannon. It was a shell firing gun,
mm-hmm.
and it was the largest in the world and still is. I forget what it was called, but I guess that was one of the main. What was that? World War II, though, right? Yeah.
Well, up until then, they had I forget if it was the German or the French, but they had the largest gun that had been used up until then, and they had to bring it upright with a crane.
Yeah,
and
it was on a train.
Yeah, they were hitting things that were like out of the horizon, out of viewpoint away, and you could hear it when they launched it in near Paris, you could hear it in London.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Like,
out of the horizon, I think it's, 10 miles you can see on flat land?
Yeah, and they were launching
like
it way
that.
Farther than
yeah.
that. There's so much minutia about World War I that, like, a real World War I expert is like a Jedi master. Like,
oh,
it
yeah.
is very, very difficult to keep all of this straight because it's there's no rhyme or reason. Like, there's no reason behind these charges. There's no reason, like, these charges against machine gun nests and all these losses. There's no reason for these countries to be in the war in the first place.
Right.
Oftentimes, they were conscripted, so there's no real, like, personal reason for the soldiers to want to be there.
Right.
It is just a fucking madhouse.
Well, isn't this a music podcast?
It is, and we're getting there.
Okay.
And that's why. So you might be asking, why do we talk about all this?
Yeah.
Right?
Why are we talking about all this?
Because context is everything.
Okay. All right.
So you've got to understand what the 369th is walking into and what
yeah.
the world is like for them. So this was the reality for the troops on the front in World War I, from Western Europe to Russia to Africa. And it was the reality for the 369th when it found itself thrust into action in spring of 1918. They were first relegated to supply and service jobs, like we were talking about. So they're in the behind the lines, because they didn't think they'd be good enough to be frontline troops.
The black regiments?
Yes.
Okay.
So by fall, though, they had suffered so many losses that it's like, well, we got to put everybody in. So the 369th went on the offensive, and for 6 months... That's 180 days.
Wow.
This was their
Some
reality
quick math.
Every single day. I mean, I've had about a week. Even this last week has been a tough, not tough week. It's been this crazy week.
It seemed like the stars have been out of line. For sure.
All over the place, man. But it's like, compared to what these poor bastards are going through. The only bright spot.
We've got car trouble, and we're
and we're sitting here.
But we don't have to hack our mechanic to death.
I've seen
with a shovel
less than a dozen rats today. I'll say that. Yeah, I haven't had to hack anybody to death with a shovel in the last week. I'll tell you that.
I could say honestly, neither have I. But that's a good thing.
Like we said, boring week.
Boring week.
The only bright spots. The only bright spots in this horrible experience were rare reprieves to the rear lines during breaks, where they would get some measure of good food, a warm bed, and maybe procure some female companionship, however temporary. Another bright spot was shown particularly brightly during those times was the innovative jazzy style of the regiment's marching band.
Here we go.
Jazz was a new sound, one that had been heard of in Europe, but not actually heard very much at the time.
Right.
The marching band of the 369.
It's mostly American.
Right. Yeah. And it was just in its infancy. Hadn't been around very long. The marching band of the 369th would, in fact, be the first major introduction of jazz music to the continent.
That is so cool.
The group's skill, flair, and innovation would be traced back to their heralded and beloved leader, the legendary James Reese Europe.
Wow.
Ever heard of James Reese Europe?
Well, I can honestly say we did not learn this at all when getting a music degree.
No.
Is so interesting.
So you were wondering why we were going all that roundabout way. Yeah. But it makes sense now. Jedi mind trick.
Well, here we are. Now
so
what?
This, you're going to have to keep in mind the guy's name is Europe. So we're going to have to make some real distinctions here between talking about
Europe.
Okay. So Europe, James Reese Europe.
Maybe we can say it like Europe.
Europe. Was born. I think we probably shouldn't out of respect for Europe.
Yeah, all right. Yeah.
Much love, Europe family. Hope you're checking this podcast out. Europe was born in Mobile, Alabama. Mobile?
I would say Mobile.
Give us a shout out, Alabama listeners. Love you. Roll Tide. And also. Roll Tide, man. To Henry. He was born in Mobile, Alabama to Henry and Laura Europe. His family, which included his older sisters Minnie and Ida and older brother John, moved to Washington, D.C. in 1890 when he was 10 years old. While in D.C., he studied violin under Enrico Hurley, the assistant director of the Marine Corps Band. At age 14, he entered a music writing contest and took second place. His little sister, Mary Europe, took first place.
Oh, what a little cunt.
What a very talented family is what I was going to say. But yeah, maybe you're right.
To be an older brother and lose to your little sister, that's got to be, oh, shitty.
Sean Amur is telling it like it is.
He's going to join the military and kill as many people as he can just because of that one thing.
Why, you think that's how this is going to end up?
Well, no.
Chopping the shark. In 1904, at the age of 24, he moved to New York City. In New York City, he formed and fronted several bands, mostly playing show tunes and minstrel tunes.
Show tunes are jazz.
Right. So jazz is in its infancy, and everything I read about this described as what he was playing at that time as proto-jazz.
Okay.
So like...
Prototype?
Pre-jazz, but still jazz, but like it's that very... And we'll play some music for you, but it's still that very big band jazz.
Yep.
So there's a really like downstroke rhythm.
Yep.
Like it's not the freeform jazzy jazz.
Yet. Right. Talking about coffee shops.
You're right, though. It's very heavily influenced by like show
coffee
tunes.
Coffee shops and turtlenecks.
Not there yet. Not there with the clapping, clicking beatniks yet.
Spoken word.
No. God, how annoying are clicking beatniks. Good, oh, my God. So in New York, he formed and fronted several bands. His ultimate goal was to break the color barrier on Broadway, taking his music all over the country and then all over the world.
What a fucking powerhouse this guy is.
Yeah, he's a real, like, and
what
he was...
What the fuck? For him to set a goal to, like, you know, I mean, it seems like acting at the time was a real exclusive society.
Yeah.
And to be like, you know what, I'm gonna break the color barrier, fuck, that's it. That's
well, he means like getting his music on Broadway.
Okay.
But like, yeah, to break that. Yeah.
Right.
And to just, he's not looking to like make it as a jazz musician. He is a like P. Diddy takeover dude. Like Jay-Z, Like, I'm here to change the game. So, James Reese...
probably going to get shot by his, like, West Coast rival or something like
that.
We
shall see. He sought to take jazz out of the dark and into the light. And he began by performing a revolutionary group... by forming a revolutionary group called the Clef Club.
Okay.
Which is tough to say, but Clef Club.
Clef Club.
Yeah.
It is tough to say.
It was comprised of up to 125 members.
Wow.
This is from jazz.com. It's spelled J-A-S-S, just like the old school jazz spelling.
Okay.
So jazz.com. The Clef Club was unique in that it was partly fraternal organization and part union. The building it purchased was on West 53rd Street and served as both a club and an office for bookings. Its board included William Tyers, previously an arranger for Stern Music Publishing Company, which is like a super famous publishing company in New York. Its treasurer assistant was Henry Creamer, who would later pair with Turner Layton to write many popular songs. And Europe was the Clef Club's first elected president, as well as the conductor of its symphony orchestra.
Oh, wow.
Which means he's a ballin' motherfucker.
I can't get over a question that I have about the Clef Club. I'm wondering if all of the members knew all of the parts, so like they could be like, you know,
no.
Swapped out.
I could answer that for you,
okay.
Yes. So, what? No, not at all.
Okay.
In fact, he said that less than a quarter of them could really read music
all.
Okay. And a lot of times some of them couldn't even play.
Okay.
And they would be hired just to like mime their instruments.
That's
or they'd put
cool.
rubber strings on their instruments. And he'd have the guys that could.
That's not going to work.
He'd have the guys that could read music sit in the middle.
Okay.
And then the guys that couldn't would sit around them. And the guys would read. And then the other guys would play off of the chords that they were playing.
That's interesting. Okay.
So he's like, yeah, I would have the guy that knew how to read music sit in the middle. And then the other guys that knew how to play a little bit would sit around him. And the guys that were faking it would sit on the outside. But we have a big band, you know.
Right.
So prior to this era, some establishments hired... this is really kind of blew my mind. They hired musicians primarily as waiters and bartenders who also happened to be expected to entertain the guests.
Hmm.
Which is really bizarre to me.
When was this again?
Let's say pre-World War One. So 1910 to 1912. So when an act
sounds
was,
like a pretty cool bar if your bartender can mix your drink and then, you know, play a show
also,
tune.
But how are you supposed to do it at the same time?
Right.
That set will take forever. When an act was booked through the
nobody gets
club,
any drinks. They don't have to worry about drinking and driving.
That didn't make any sense to me. The musicians were hired solely as when the act was booked through the Clef Club, the musicians were hired solely as entertainers, and they received a salary, transportation, room and board. The club proved
that's like not even existent today.
Right, they got a ridiculous
that's really
deal.
Cool.
The club proved exceptionally successful, generating over $100,000 a year in bookings at the height of its popularity. Meanwhile, jazz was a good time dancing music, and the most famous dancers in New York at the time were a couple named Vernon and Irene Castle. After meeting the Castles at a private party, they decided to make him their band leader. And his rendition of the W.C. Handy song Memphis Blues would provide the rhythmic backdrop for the creation of one of Vernon and Irene's most famous dance steps, the Foxtrot.
Get out of here.
Yes, sir.
Oh, wow.
The Foxtrot.
I was wondering if they met each other while he was working at the private party. Because, like, minstrel or, like, chamber music, they would be playing while party's
it's
going
sure,
on.
You know, I don't, I could not definitively tell you because
maybe
everything
tending,
that
maybe
I,
maybe he was tending bar.
I don't know. It could have been because everything that I found just said that they met at a private party. They didn't even say if he was like perform. I'm guessing though, he must have been performing there because it sounds like they heard his music.
Okay.
And then said, well, you want to be our band leader. So
cool.
I'm guessing that
right.
they must have, he must have been playing at the party. So anyways, in 1914, after disputes in the Clef Club, Europe resigned as president and continued to lead the band for the Castles, eventually adding in wind instruments like the saxophone, and all the while honing his sound. Then, when America finally entered World War I in 1917, he enlisted as a private in the U.S. Army. He eventually took and passed the officer's exam and was asked by his commanding officer to form a regimental band like the one he had led as a civilian. This would be a difficult task indeed because he couldn't pull the guys from it. It'd be like the Blues Brothers trying
right.
to like, well, I can't get him back from that high paying gig, you know, like there's no way he can go get all the old guys that he had because he's not
right.
going to get them on military pay away from their nice New York jobs.
What happened to the Marine Corps guy, the leader
of
the
Marine Corps? That was just like mentor when he was young.
Oh, okay.
I don't even know if he was still in the Marine Corps at this time. Honestly, I didn't do enough research on the Marine Regimental Band Leader.
Hmm.
Press for time. I only have so much time to be an expert in things. He eventually took and passed the officer's exam. Talk about that. This would be a difficult task for him to round up all the people that he needed, and it would require him to travel as far as Puerto Rico to acquire the reed players willing to enlist in the U.S. Army and play in a band.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Going on down to Puerto Rico.
to enlist American soldiers.
Come on down. Come join the Army.
Yeah.
And play reed.
I wonder what his pitch was.
Hey. You want to play reed in the Army?
Okay. Oh, that was easier than I thought.
I'm picturing a stripes scenario.
You didn't even have to call Teddy Roosevelt.
He got Teddy VIP seats, I'm sure. Teddy had like the VIP lanyard.
Right.
Yeah, I'm here to see James.
He had it tattooed.
Yeah, he just had like a tattoo on his neck that says bully. Yeah. After arriving,
little known fact, that's where that comes from.
All right, we're going to have to differentiate right here between the name and the place. So after arriving in Europe, the continent, on New Year's Day, 1918, the 369th Regimental Band would play it at every small town they passed through on the way to the front. And they also jammed with British and French regimental bands. And they, upon hearing the new jazz music, the band leader from the, I think the British, either British or French bands, he asked for some sheet music. He said, like, well, this is crazy.
There's no such thing as sheet music for jazz.
They managed to write some out for him, and then he looked at it, and then he just goes, no, you guys must have, like, rigged instruments, because there's no way that you could be making these sounds. So he just figured that...
What a hater, man.
Yeah, I know.
Jeez.
Way to go, French guy.
Typical French.
The jazz bug had bitten Europe hard, Europe the continent.
This is getting way too confusing.
Yeah, I know.
If we throw another Europe in here...
It's tough. It's tough, okay? And it was only fitting that a man named Europe would be the one to spread it. Get what I'm saying there?
Oh, I get it. I'm picking up what you're putting down.
However, this was still a war, and James Reese, Europe, and the 369th Regiment were soon sent to the front. It's from Wikipedia here.
Right, like, how did they have all this time to tour the world and play music?
They're not touring the world. They're just going through Europe on the way to the front, because you can't fly guys on a helicopter to the front. Like, you got to walk them to the front. This is, like, pretty much the last war... Not the last walking war, but the last one where, like, your major modes of transportation were walking and
forces.
Ships.
Yeah.
Like, if you're on water, we can ship you there, but if you're on land, even then, like, if you've got millions of soldiers, you don't have millions of horses.
Right.
So, and then automobiles they have.
There's no Jeeps.
There are some proto Jeeps, but they're just kind of shitty, and they're not going to get you to the muck and mud on the way to the front. So, on September, this is from Wikipedia, on September 25th, 1918, the French 4th Army went on the offensive in conjunction with the American drive in Meuse-Argonne. The 369th turned in a good account in heavy fighting, sustaining severe losses. They captured the important village of Sechaux. At one point, the 369th advanced faster than French troops on their right and left flanks and risked being cut off. By the time the regiment pulled back for reorganization, it had advanced nearly 9 miles through severe German resistance.
Wow.
9 miles. Like, try walking nine miles.
Not no miles. Nine miles.
Nine. Yeah, not the German nine. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, but try going for a 9 mile walk by not being shot at by machine guns. And...
Nine miles, Europe, leading Europe. This is all too much.
This is a tough one. Told you World War I is confusing. In mid-October, the regiment was moved to a quiet sector in the Vosges Mountains. Europe, can we... The continent of Europe, I'm addressing you right now. Yes. Can we do something about these names? They're very hard for my American tongue.
All right, we'll have to start using numbers.
My American capitalist,
color-coding system.
Freedom-loving tongue won't bend around your crazy names.
Right.
It was there on the 11th of November.
Maybe it's the elevation.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to go
it,
for.
It could very well.
On the 11th of November, the day of armistice, 6 days later, that's where they were. They were in the Vosges Mountains. 6 days later, the 369th made its last advance, and on the 26th of November, reached the banks of the Rhine River. They were the first Allied unit to reach the Rhine River in World War I.
Wow.
Which is amazing.
So were they really good soldiers?
We're going to get to that. The regiment was relieved on December 12, 1918 from assignment, and they returned to New York and were demobilized on the 28th of February, 1919 at Camp Upton. By the war's end, the Harlem Hellcats, as they had now become called, were the most decorated unit in the U.S. military, having earned every bit of their war-fighting moniker.
That is awesome, man.
Two medals of honor. This is, again, from Wikipedia.
And who says musicians are deadbeats?
Well, they're not all musicians. They were the regimental band for the 369th. But right. This is like, yeah, this is a group of guys that were told, like, you're probably not good enough to be on the front lines. And check out what they won. Or, I mean, what they, I guess, they earned, but keep in mind how horrific this war that they went through was.
So this is bittersweet.
How badass these guys are. Two medals of honor and many distinguished service crosses were awarded to members of the regiment, which is the DSC, the Distinguished Service Cross, is the second highest honor that can be given. So there's a medal of honor. So for two medals of honor to be given in one regiment is amazing.
Yeah.
And many distinguished service crosses is amazing. And then the most celebrated man in the 369th was Private Henry Johnson, a former Albany, New York rail station porter who earned the nickname Black Death for his actions in combat in France. In May in 1918, Johnson and Private Needham Roberts, sounds like a bad motherfucker,
right,
too.
Right.
They fought off a 24-man German patrol, though they were both severely wounded. After they expended their ammunition, Roberts used his rifle as a club, and Johnson battled with a bolo knife.
Oh,
reports suggest that Johnson killed at least 4 German soldiers and might have wounded as many as 30 others. Usually, black achievements and valor went unnoticed, despite the fact that over 100 men from the 369th were presented with American and or French medals.
It's impressive.
Over 100 of them.
John Rambo's father, right?
I mean, I don't know that John Rambo was biracial, but I'm not saying no.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
How about that for an answer?
I'll take that.
Right. So they also got six, let's see here. Johnson also got the Croix de Guerre, which is the Medal of Honor for France. So he basically, right, like...
Again, made of cheese.
Yes, also, but
the medal that keeps on giving.
Yes, it is. Unless it's summertime and then it goes away quickly. No, but with all due respect to the Croix de Guerre, like they won an amazing amount. I mean, like,
right,
it's unheard of for somebody to pull that, for a regiment to pull down this
it
amount of
award. It seems like they were pretty much written off from the beginning.
Yes, until the end.
Yeah, until they were actually...
And Europe was a part of this. He was actively on the front line. So, like, yes, they were part of the regimental band, but I'm not construing that as they weren't active combatants.
Right.
They were... he was a officer in charge, so he was leading men in combat as well. So, just an amazing thing that anyone could make it through 6 months of that and survive it, much less come out with any kind of doing anything... extraordinary,
right? And it's unheard of, like I said, here in Texas, at, you know, not quite university level, but we don't even learn about this guy.
No.
So,
and someone that's just hugely important. I mean, like, he really,
right,
helped.
Although I guess if you needed a history major, it would be a bit different, but.
Yeah, but I mean, for someone that's studying, I mean, for the spread of jazz,
right,
out of America, that's
right,
a pretty...
It's something that you wouldn't necessarily gloss over.
That is a pretty seminal event. So upon arriving home, the 369th Marching Band was sent on a farewell tour throughout the spring of 1919. James Rhys Europe's vision of bringing the music he loved not only to the world, but to the country which he had fought and bled for, was finally being realized. The band was held in high regard throughout the country and was known as one of the best in the world, and crowds poured into shows to show their appreciation for both the band's contribution to the Great War and to the truly original American music that they performed. However, on the last night of the tour at Mechanics Hall in Boston on May 9th, 1919, Europe's drummer Herbert Wright, one half of the vaunted Percussion Twins... Yes, those Percussion Twins. He became angry with Europe. Europe was known to be an exacting taskmaster. He was not afraid to get in your face, not afraid of an argument, not afraid to get things done his way.
Right.
And he was more than willing to employ his force of will to get the result that he wanted out of his band.
But with, you know, a jacket full of medals.
A jacket full of medals and a real musical reputation, right. A decade of musical reputation
preceding him. He pretty much gets what he wants.
Right. Yeah. So he was, you know, on this night, though, they got into an argument during the intermission, and things went much too far. After getting into a brief, heated argument, Herbert Wright pulled out a penknife and stabbed James Reese Europe in the neck.
No.
For a time, it seemed the venerable band leader.
I thought you were going to say a drumstick.
No, sir.
Oh, penknife.
Penknife.
Drummers.
He pulled out, I know, right? For a time, it seemed the venerable band leader would pull through. As at the scene, he calmly told his bandmates to be ready at 9 a.m. the next day for another show. However, the bleeding could not be stopped. James Reese Europe was rushed to the hospital, but his jugular vein had been severed, and he succumbed to blood loss before that night.
What the hell, man?
Yeah.
What a terrible way to go.
The next morning, the local papers and papers nationwide ran the headline, "The Jazz King is Dead."
Wow.
Yeah, heavy duty.
That was real heavy duty.
To come home from the war, not even a year
just
later.
Just getting a fight with your drummer.
Stabs you in the neck.
Fucking A. You know how many guys, like, he stabbed in the neck to stay alive? And
very
then,
good point.
You know, wasn't even expecting it. What a cheap shot. Oh, my God.
So, of James Reese Europe, his band...
Well, we don't know what they were fighting about.
I think they were just... He was just...
To their credit.
The accounts that I read, it wasn't like... There was no accounts that I read ever of James Reese Europe not paying his band members or not treating them well on a personal level.
Okay.
It was like he was a controlling musician, but there was nothing about him being abusive or either verbally or physically.
So he wasn't like James Brown?
No, he wasn't. He didn't. There were no accounts of, and I'm not saying they don't exist, but the ones that I found in researching for this episode, there were no negative character references for James Reese Europe. It was mostly like this guy was a dickhead that lost his mind. And, you know, yes, was he a bit of a... Was James Reese Europe a bit of a control freak?
But he earned it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like... And so, sorry that part of the Rhythm Twins doesn't get to make his calls, right. But...
Well, he was upset that he had to share everything with his
brothers. So they get into this argument. He gets stabbed in the neck. Ends up passing away. Of James Reese Europe, his bandmate and good friend, UB Blake, would later say, "He was our benefactor and inspiration. Even more, he was the Martin Luther King of music at the time." His best friend and right-hand man, Noble Sissel, who was there when he got stabbed.
Such cool names.
Such cool names. That was going to be a point of mine later. Yeah, these are the coolest names. UB Blake and Noble Sissel, dude. Yeah. A jazz pioneer and an OG forefather in his own right. He remembered him like this. There was only one Jim Europe. And he had not just... And Noble Sissel had also been in the 369th, so he'd been to war with them. There was only one Jim Europe, and he had not just been made with that band of his. There was years of experience behind that sweep of his arms, and anyone who tried to follow him would just be out of his mind. I was sure that conducting was not the field in which I was to carry on in his life's dream. In my mind, his band should remain in the memory of those who heard it led by Lieutenant James Reese Europe, and that's how it ended.
Wow.
They offered him to keep conducting with his band. He said, no. If it wasn't James Reese Europe, it wasn't the same.
So it's not like AC/DC, where they carried on the best. They ended it there.
He decided that was it.
That's a heavy story.
So,
man.
James Reese Europe was laid to rest with full military honors at Arlington National Cemetery.
Did he have any family?
He didn't have any kids or like wife that I found. But in closing, we'll turn to W.C. Handy. His take on James Reese Europe was, and his take on who James Reese Europe was and how much he meant to his community, his contemporaries, and to his country. W.C. Handy wrote, "The man who had just come through the baptism of war's fire and steel without a mark had been stabbed by one of his own musicians. The sun was in the sky, the new day promised peace, but all the suns had gone down for Jim Europe, and Harlem didn't see them the same."
Oh, wow, man.
So that's the story of James
Reese
Europe.
Something I pictured like Sam Elliott saying that.
I pictured James Earl Jones.
Okay.
But I hear you, yeah.
The sun had gone down, dude.
Harlem would never be the same. So we hope you've enjoyed this episode of All Damn Night. Thanks again for tuning in. We are currently getting everything rolling online, so we are...
Check out our Patreon.
Sean's done an amazing job setting up the Patreon
Email
page.
Us suggestions.
You can find us on the social media, twitter.com/alldamnnight, instagram.com/alldamnnightpodcast. Give us a follow there. facebook.com/alldamnnightpodcast. alldamnnightpodcast@gmail.com if you want to hit us up, like Sean said, with any show suggestions. And like we said, give the Patreon a look. There's a bunch of cool things we're getting in the works and getting set up. Sean's done an awesome job on that. Check that out. There'll be a lot more on that to come. And again,
a couple cooperative excellent topics coming up,
some great stuff coming up. We've got some big episodes coming up, a big event planned, a couple big events planned, so make sure you stay tuned. And again, thanks for tuning in. Always appreciate it, and we'll see you next time on All Damn Night.